So this week we have coming up tomorrow, Mary Allen, Working with Time, The Key to Writings. This is about finding writing time in busy, hectic lives. And then on Thursday, we're going to have a talk on small presses and the kind of history of the small press, and then a kind of current trajectory of the small press and what that might mean for us as writers if we want to publish on small presses. So that's what we have coming up. And then Friday is our illustrious faculty reading. So come to that at 11 o'clock. And you can see if they've really got the goods or not. Test them. So today, we have Susan Taylor Chihak talking about going graphic, what the storytelling secrets of comics can tell us about narrative technique. I'm really excited about this. I recently read The Watchmen, and so I'm pretty curious about graphic novels and what that can help us as writers to think about. I'm just going to give you a quick biography. Susan is the author of 5 novels, including Smithereens, The Story of Annie D, and Harmony. Her short stories have appeared in Folio, Co-Review, Guernica Magazine, and the Adirondack Review, among other places. As her pseudonymous alter ego, Catherine Dow, Susan has recently published a new novel, The Great Disappointment, A Confession, as an ebook from Foreverland Press. She is also the driving force behind Foreverland Press, an ebook publisher devoted to bringing back the backlist of fine writers who might have otherwise been overlooked. Another of her online projects includes What Happened to Paula, a collaborative web-based investigation into the as-yet-unsolved murder of a former schoolmate. Susan has taught fiction writing in the low residency MFA program at Antioch University at Los Angeles, the UCLA Extension Writers Program, and the University of Southern California. Coming to us from sunny California, please give a round of applause for Susan Chihak.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I turned it on, I did all right. Back pocket, hold on a second. I actually am coming to you from Colorado because we abandoned Hollywood for the Rocky Mountains. And we're living up there. Lucky me. Thank you for coming to this today. I have been looking at graphic novels as a way of storytelling and decided to spend this year making a study of the graphic novel and beginning to understand it, because I'm not a person who grew up with comic books. I didn't read them as a child. My mother would have been appalled. Because, of course, it's just junk, right? That's why they only cost 10 cents, because they had no value. Because I'm interested in comics and I'm interested in the graphic novel particularly, partly because it seemed like it would be easier to draw pictures than have to deal with language, which is so hard. I mean, my God, 100,000 words, I got to write a novel, I can do it in fewer pictures, right? How hard can that be? Can I draw it myself? It doesn't have to be literally, you know, like paintings, does it? I happen to be at Associated Writing Programs. This is what's going to happen when I do this, okay? I have to jump over here and do that to get to the next slide. So I'll be doing some moving around. AWP in Boston this year had a panel on illustrated novels, and this was the description of it with these people. This may be the age of the graphic novel, but it's in an age that embraces illustration and serious literature, because people at Associated Writing Programs don't want to be talking about comic books, so they want to connect it with serious literature. And this is the work of the authors who were on the panel. Josh Wheel, Reef Larson, Stan Mack, Ron Tanner, and Mira Bartok. And if you are familiar with any of those writers, they're all amazing. They've done amazing things with graphic bits being part of their work. The main point that they were making, though, in that panel, as they talked about what they were doing, was that the graphics were there to illuminate the text, not to illustrate it. So it's not a literal picturing of what is happening on the page, but actually an illumination, taking it a step further by adding the graphics to it. This interested me hugely.
I love the idea that there's more to it than just illustration. These are some illustrated novels that you...
This was being done back at the turn of the previous century with Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue. Pamela was one that was, and we know Dickens also, and Alice in Wonderland. Those all have become famous, famous illustrations to the novels, but they were illustrations. They were showing what was happening in the language on the page by giving us a picture of what was going on. But it still shows us how the pictures and the words interact a little bit. This one, Murders in the Rue Morgue, when I was a girl growing up, I had that, and I bought it since again, that edition of the Edgar Allan Poe stories. It has the woodcuts in it. There's also one of Jane Eyre in Wuthering Heights, and scared the pee out of me. I mean, just like very scary stuff to look at these pictures, much more accessible than the actual stories themselves. So I was greatly influenced by that sort of thing.
So then Rudolf Topfler, coming right after that, and you see his little bio there,
he was the first one to make independent combinations of words and pictures. So it's now no longer based on a novel, but is actually, he's telling stories like the comic book we're familiar with, where, and this is back, look how long ago that was, that he was doing it. So of course I had to go buy all of his books and look at all of, see how he was doing it. They tend to be funny, they're sort of comic little episodes in the lives of his characters that he's invented.
Scott McCloud is one aficionado of comics.
He writes books about, he makes comics, but he also writes books about comics and what they mean. So I'm going to rely a lot on his theories. This is the definition of comics that he has come up with, relying on some other theorists as well. So this is what, it's important to think about, I said graphics in my title, going graphic in the title here, but this term comics now has become the term for Watchmen, all of those graphic books, novels that you're looking at that are all graphics, they call them comics now. And this is, and that doesn't mean they're funny, the same way that in true language, comedy doesn't necessarily have to be funny. It's a style of storytelling that may not be funny. Comics may not be funny either. Alison Bechdel comes to mind with Funhouse and Are You My Mother? Used as a juxtaposed pictorial and other images in deliberate sequence intended to convey information and or to produce an aesthetic response in the viewer. Now you could say that a story, a narrative is the same thing, only substitute words, and it's kind of the same thing. So we'll work with that definition of what comics are as we're talking through, as I'm talking through the rest of this talk.
McCloud points out several ways in which words and pictures can interact in comics. They can illustrate the text. I can't see what I'm looking at here.
How am I going to do this? I guess I'll...
This is a podcast, too, so people listening to stuff are too.
Can hear you.
Yeah, I know. No, that's right, because I still have to go over here.
Oh, okay.
I'm just going to say it, and you find it on here, okay? And I won't point it out. Pictures can illustrate a text which is largely complete on its own. That would be the books that I was talking about earlier, Dickens and Peter Cottontail, Alice in Wonderland. It can provide a soundtrack to a sequence that's composed visually so that the words then sort of play in the background behind what's going on. Sometimes that'll be like the bang and the poof and the pop that shows up. Words and pictures can replicate one another, so you may have a picture of an apple and below it will say apple. Words can clarify or amplify pictures or vice versa, so that the words can give you more than what the picture can do, can embellish it, amplify it, make it mean more for you than just a picture just sitting there so that you understand it more completely. Words can function as elements in a picture, so that sometimes, I mean, that'll be maybe the dialogue, or it'll say, it'll be part of what the picture is, the words will be showing up in there. I think these are all here, right? Are you seeing them? Words and pictures can work together to convey an idea that neither can convey alone. That's the parallel one, where they're both working together on a parallel track, and each one's conveying part of what the idea is, and without the other, they can't really say the whole of what's being said. Or they can stand in ironic juxtaposition to each other. Well, he's got a montage there, a picture of a pipe with written underneath, "This is not a pipe." So you get an ironic juxtaposition. The most common type of word picture combination is when they're interdependent in some way. And that'll show up in most of the graphic books where the two are interdependent. So, with this, you have the guy looking at his big hand there. If it was just a picture of him looking at his big hand, it doesn't have the meaning of, "This is all I need to stop him." If you don't have the picture of him looking at his hand, you don't know what the "this" refers to. So they're interdependent with each other. Each one needs the other in order for the meaning to come across. Okay. This is all seems fairly obvious. But what happens is, when that interdependence is really working, it creates a synergy between the words and the picture that creates something else altogether beyond what either one of them is. They have that, so their combined effect is greater than or different from what we might have predicted. And this little cartoon of the word and the picture, I'm just saying, I seem to do all the talking in this relationship. Look, I'm trying to show you how I feel. Words tie meaning down. We use words in order to mean something specific. When I say table, it means something. It's not a chair. It's a table. It's very specific. You might have a different kind of table pop into your mind. You might have an image that pops into your mind. But we all have agreed, because we speak the same language, what a table means and what it does. So words are very specific. They tie meanings down. They limit interpretive possibility. They signify, they stand for something. So when we're writing stories, we're writing our prose, and we put a word down, it stands for something, and we control what it stands for. We chose that word rather than another in order to be specific about what it is we want to talk about. Pictures, on the other hand, represent reality as it really is in all its complexity and wildness. And I picked this one because it's a Victorian picture of fairies, supposedly a photograph, and the idea that a photograph somehow represents real reality is the truth has long been the difference between photography and painting, for example. One is a personal representation of reality, the other is reality as it is, unless it's a fairies and it's been photoshopped. But they didn't have Photoshop back then, so I don't know. That's a real photo from the Victorian time. Fairy hunters. Pictures are also more universal. than words of any language. We have all these signals, all these icons, pictures that anybody of any language understands and can. So you can transcend language with pictures and make it so that you don't have to know what the word really means. It's just a picture we get in our mind and it signifies whatever we've decided it does. Yet the more dominant the role played by images in comics narrative, the more difficult it becomes for the artist and the reader to communicate. So this is a very complex picture. It's going to take you a while to decipher what it means, if it means anything, if it's worth your trouble, you don't know. To make sense of the information presented in each panel, the reader must look closely, puzzle out the logical relationships, and as with a verbal narrative, infer what comes next. That's what we're constantly doing in storytelling, right? We're inferring, well, you know, she dropped her money in the hallway, she's not going to be able to afford lunch. We infer what's going to happen next because of what we saw. But if that had been an illustration of a dollar lying in the hallway and somebody walking stepping on it and getting it wet, we don't really know what to infer from that. We're going to have to figure it out by whatever comes next or what's come before in order to understand. So that turns out to be a limitation of pictures in terms of the relationship between the reader and the text and the writer and what he means to get the reader to understand about what he's presenting. There's a limitation to that, but as with all limitations, there's also a huge freedom in that. And that's what this whole talk is going to end up being about, is that freedom and how much it involves the viewer, the reader, in the text so that she becomes an actual part of it, and instead of it being just sort of fed the way when we read work. And in theory, this has been called a demonstration at the graphic level of what the early symbolist poets were trying to do with words. And I don't know a lot about poetry, but here's what this is. The Symbolist Manifesto. Jean Maurois, I don't know if I'm saying that right. Symbolists believed that art should represent absolute truths that could only be described indirectly. Thus, they wrote in a very metaphorical and suggestive manner, endowing particular images or objects with symbolic meaning. The Symbolist Manifesto was published on September 18, 1886, in Le Figaro, where he announced that symbolism was hostile to, quote, plain meanings, declarations, false sentimentality, and matter-of-fact description, and that its goal was to, quote, clothe the ideal in a perceptible form, whose, quote, goal was not in itself, but whose sole purpose was to express the ideal. So the idea was to take the words and make them more than just a table, but whatever that table symbolizes in, and get the essence of it that way through language. They wanted to liberate techniques of versification in order to allow greater room for fluidity, and as such were sympathetic with the trend toward free verse as evidence, and blah, blah, blah. Symbolist poems were attempts to evoke rather than primarily to describe. Symbolic imagery was used to signify the state of the poet's soul. From there we move to imagism, which is another movement in the early 20th century Anglo-American poetry that favored precision of imagery and clear, sharp language. So it's sort of like what we're saying with photographs versus paintings. It's actually describing precisely what something looked like without any interpretation of what that's supposed to mean. And this is Ezra Pound's, and what they wanted to do was isolate a single image in order to reveal its essence. And so here's Ezra Pound in a station of the metro, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. readers were meant to see, experience, and empathize rather than conventionally to understand. So there's nothing to really understand about that. What you get from that poem is the feeling, the emotional feeling, but also the visual feeling just from the words. What that means is that as a reader of a poem like that, you're bringing yourself into the text. It's only an image. Whatever meaning you're getting from it isn't coming from the poem. It's coming from whatever you put on that image and how it affects you, whatever memory or anything, whatever's going on in your own life, in your own soul. That's what's going to be projected into that poem. It's not coming from the poem itself. It's simply an image that we're all looking at. That leads me to the main part of what I want to talk about here, and that's this idea of closure.
Closure is what our brains do. Well, I'll just read this. The law of closure states that individuals perceive objects such as shapes, letters, pictures, and so on as being whole when they are not complete. Specifically, when parts of a whole picture are missing, our perception fills the visual gap. And this little picture of him standing on the, you're filling in the rest of him behind that wall. Your brain does it. You know that his shoulder and the rest of his body behind that wall, although you can't see it. Your brain automatically fills it in. And your brain does this all the time. You're always filling, because nothing is complete. There's always gaps. And your brain automatically, it's part of our brains, our cognition, it's part of our survival mechanisms to fill in the gaps, to figure out what it is we're looking at. And this is an example of closure. We see, even though there's no, this one, there's no triangle there, we see it in the middle of that. We fill in the spaces in order to see the shapes that are not completely full. That's closure. And I think there's a developmental time in a child when that starts to happen. And I think it's also something that gets lost as we age as well, where things stop seeming to make sense because we can't fill in those gaps anymore. So you know how important it is for us. Here's what happens with cartoon faces, comics faces.
As they get more cartoony, they also get more, there are more gaps for us to fill in for ourselves. And this is an illustration of the universality of faces. That the first one, which is very detailed, very realistic face, it really only represents one person. Only one person looks exactly, unless he's got a twin. That's the only person that looks exactly like that. A few of them look kind of like that guy. Thousands look like that guy because it's very generalized. Millions look like that guy because that's just eyes and nose, and it just happens to have dark hair and it's a man. But the last one, nearly everybody looks like that in some way because it's just a round head. The more cartoony a face is, the more people it could be said to describe. What happens, and this is something from Dickens, this is what Charles Dickens does, is he does not describe the faces of his main characters. You don't know what David Copperfield looks like. You may get an idea of what he's wearing and all of that, but you won't see his face. He's basically an eye and nose, two eyes and two, and whatever, he's not, doesn't have two noses. Two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, and that's who he is. But the side characters, the minor characters, become almost like pieces of furniture. They get described very, very clearly because they don't have personality. Well, they have personality, but we're not in their consciousness. We're not following them. We're not identifying with them. We're not becoming them the way we're becoming David Copperfield as we read the book. We're just looking at them as someone other. And so they become, this is Mr. Turveydrop, even his name is a part of who he is. Where David Copperfield, it really isn't. It's a much more, you could put yourself and become David Copperfield. He was a fat old gentleman with a false complexion, false teeth, false whiskers, and a wig, and so on, all the way through. That's the description of Mr. Turveydrop. And that's the same thing that this comics thing that I'm talking about is, the generalizing the main characters so that we can put ourselves into their place.
What happens is, when you have,
when you look at a photo or a realistic drawing of a face, you see the face of another, someone else. But when you enter the world of the cartoon, you see yourself, and you become the character that you're looking at, or that you're reading about. The cartoon is a vacuum into which our identity and awareness are pulled, an empty shell that we inhabit, which enables us to travel in another realm. We don't just observe a cartoon, we become it. And to take that even a step further, if we eliminate captions, if we eliminate the words and only give the pictures, then we've allowed now the reader to completely have to be a part of the story by figuring out what the story is. Franz Masuriel was the first one to do this in any big way. A Flemish painter and graphic artist who worked mainly in France, and he did woodcuts that are entire novels that are like this. This one is about a writer and he goes to the sun, basically. But you have to watch, you have to look at each picture and spend some time with it. It actually takes longer to read this than it would to read a novel, and you can read it again and again and find different bits of it that you didn't get, like that little face behind him, things like that that you don't notice when you're first flipping through. So there's a depth to just the image because it's involving. It's asking you to actually create the story, create the text yourself. Another example of this is Lynn Ward. I think I said that right. And he does the same thing. These are some examples of his work. That's a self-portrait that he did. And these are also all woodcuts, no words at all, just pictures. What happens with closure, and that's closure also, because you're filling in the story just by looking at the pictures. What happens with closure, comics panels fracture time and space, offering a jagged staccato rhythm of unconnected moments. But closure allows us to connect these moments and mentally construct a continuous, unified reality. What happens when you do that is you become a willing and conscious collaborator with the storyteller. You see the movements of this person in between what he's doing and make sense of what just happened. And this is what I love the best. It all happens in the gutter. The gutter is the white space between the panels. That empty gap between panels is where the closure happens, where there are transitions between one thing and the next that you have to figure out how the two are connected. It's in that gutter, the space between the panels. That's what comics aficionados have named the gutter, and despite its unceremonious title, the gutter plays host to much of the magic and mystery that are at the very heart of comics. Your imagination takes two separate images and transforms them into a single idea. So you look, you see this screaming guy, and then the eek in the, and something has happened in between there that you will know because of the context of the story, whatever happened before and after those two panels. We're in limbo of the gutter. Here in the limbo of the gutter, human imaginations takes two separate images and transforms them into a single, like I already said that, into a single idea. These transitions are of many different kinds. A transition that happens in the gutter can be moment to moment, so you're just skipping time, moving from a different look on her face. It can be action to action, where the ball comes, the batter hits. Subject to subject, where in this case we have a racer and a racing man and a clock. So it's the two are not, they're not the same person. It's two different things, but the subject is the same. Scene to scene, he can't outrun us forever, and then the next one is 10 years later. And pay attention to the gutter that's between these things. Is that me doing that? Aspect to aspect, so you see the beer cans on the table, and then you see these other people who are also happen to be in the room, and now you make sense of what's going on in the gutter between those two things, and non sequitur, where it's one thing and the other, and a birthday guy, and then an cubist picture and doesn't seem to be any connection, and so whatever the connection is that's happening in the gutter, you're making it up. Glenn Baxter
takes text that's in contrast to the picture and
where they don't have any relationship at all, or that the words and the text and the picture are put together in order to make some sort of ironic statement or comic statement between two things. So I love this one up here. The twins
devoted an hour each day to the walnut.
When the cartoons are in contrast to the picture, it ends up adding up to give more. There's more to it than either one. The juxtaposition of word and image, text and image, is an endlessly rich source of meaning, whether the goal is to generate dramatic tension, make readers laugh, or cause them to question their assumptions about the stability of language and representation. So, all right, this is looking at comics and seeing how they work. Now, the question is, what can we take from this to our own storytelling, which we're working in words that create images rather than images that are created, and use it for what we're doing? How can we use these concepts in what we're doing? I'm going to go back to W.G. Sebald. I don't know if any of you have read him. Anybody familiar with him? Rings of Saturn, Austerlitz, The Immigrants. He puts pictures in the text, in the stories that they're photographs, and they're not captioned. And I've always loved what he does. I've always thought that every book of his that I've read, I think is amazing. But I really don't understand it. I don't really get it. You know, I think I taught it to a few classes to hope that maybe my students would get it and they'd tell me what he was trying to do, because I didn't really understand it. Here's what it looks like. So it's kind of random. The pictures don't illustrate the text. They don't really stand, you know, you can spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the meaning of the pictures are and why that particular picture instead of another, or what really the point is of all of it. And it's hard to discover, but it's quite striking when you're reading it. Somehow it works.
There's some more of them. I think those are from Austerlitz. Rick Moody wrote this in The Believer,
which I was happy he did because it started to explain to me what it was I was loving. The photos are one of many consistent and delightful pleasures to be found therein in the books. And there's a canny, elusive, and playful way that he makes use of them. You're never certain if the thing photographed is an exact representation or a placeholder. Since there are no captions, he doesn't clear up the ambiguities for you. Nevertheless, it has occurred to me to wonder if there isn't a way that all this photography devalues the literary effect of the work. Sebald, an assiduous describer and naturalist in his own right, does a great job of describing landscapes, especially in the Rings of Saturn, where the sense of place is essential to the work. So what do the photos do that language cannot, except make us over-reliant upon them? It's up to the reader to do the work of evaluating the relevance of particular textual constituents. So that doesn't really answer very much for us, does it? This takes me to subtext. In Sebald, what it is the photos are subtext to the text. They're telling us something that's not being said in the text. It's outside, it's sort of under it. And I started reading about, I don't know how, sometimes I just pick up a book and there's something that's totally relevant to what I'm talking about. And this is what happened when I came, I don't even know what book I was reading, talking about Stephen King and horror and allegory that he uses. His stories are allegories for something else. The allegory is the horror part, and the something else is what it's really about. The insight that King offers into the work of horror is based on a bimodal, or dualistic vision, which insists upon the necessity of reading between the lines. So you might be reading about a clown who's killing little kids, but there, between those lines, that book came out at a time when there was when we were seeing kids on milk cartons, and there was great fear of strangers in parks and clowns especially, and you know the pedophiles that were lurking in every corner. That's what the book is really about. But on the surface level, it's a horror story that ends stupidly with a spider in a cave. The first mode or level which King describes is the gross-out level, that level at which a cultural norm is violated for shock effect. And examples of that are the vomit fest in the body, you know, where everybody starts throwing up. Barfarama or something it's called. Those kinds of gross out things that happen, or you know, it can be somebody tearing somebody's head off, something like that. Those are the things that on one level is what a lot of people just read King for that and don't go any farther. The second and subtextual level is between the lines. He describes as the artistic level, the second level at which horror novels seek to probe phobic pressure points which address archetypal, political, economic, and psychological rather than supernatural fears. So it's not that you're really afraid that a clown is going to come into your bedroom. There's something psychological about it that touches a nerve and you feel the horror of it and are delighted by it. Examples are fear of death, xenophobia, economic unease. This second level, according to King, gives the work of horror its pleasing allegorical feel. Once we recognize that King's bimodal vision of allegory places extraordinary emphasis upon hidden psychological anxieties or upon reading between the lines, there's the gap again, there's the gutter, we begin to see that a surprising number of parallels exist between the structure of King's allegory and the structure that Freud attributes to dreams. For Freud, it's the unconscious and that shows up in the dream. Again, it's what's underneath. It's what we're not seeing on the surface, but is hiding below that will come to the surface in a dream. He divides the dream into two basic levels of meaning, just as King divides the work of horror into the levels of gross out and subtext. The first and most obvious level of meaning in a dream, according to Freud, is the manifest or dream content level. The one that your husband tells you over breakfast the next morning and what? You know, that makes no sense and means a lot to him, but what? Really? You're telling me your dreams? Okay. But you love him, so you listen. The first and most obvious dream, physical experiences as recalled by the memory comprise this level. In other words, remembered movements, colors, sensations, and experiences compose the dream's first level of meaning. And that's usually as far as you get when somebody's telling you what their dream is, and you have to listen to it, because it doesn't mean anything. The second level of meaning in a dream, according to Freud, is the psychic or latent content level. Desires springing from the unconscious comprise this second level. For Freud, these desires, of course, invariably involve the wish fulfillment of an infantile sexual impulse, because that's Freud. Both the systems of Freud and King are bimodal. So you understand what I mean by bimodal, B-I-M-O-D-A-L. Moreover, both men argue that their bimodal systems result from the need of an individual to generate a superficial level of meaning which will disguise and hide a deeper and more disturbing level of meaning. King writes that horror fiction allows us to say things that we would be afraid to say right out straight. And Freud argues that the psyche creates the manifest content of the dream to evade censorship and to allow the dreamer to continue to sleep while expressing his suppressed and potentially disruptive desires. The allegories of King and Freud, I love King and Freud, like two people put together. Talk about a gutter between that. Frequently result from the unconscious attempt of the contemporary individual to cope with and yet hide from disruptive wishes and experiences. In short, both men use the concept of allegory to explain a kind of psychological ambiguity which results from the individual's desire to remain relatively safe and comfortable when confronting any of the many unpleasant truths of the human condition. Okay, that's a lot of words about I don't know what. Well, I do know what, you know, the difference between what's being told and what's actually going on. you may find in your workshops when you're writing your story that you're making things too, you're afraid to make things hard for your characters. You're afraid for them to fall down the stairs or get hurt or not like their father very much or not care when their mother falls and breaks her hip because she's a pain in the ass anyway. You may find that you're afraid of those things, and those are the exact places where you want to go, because that's your subtext. That's whatever it is that you're fearing is what's going to touch your readers, because they're going to read your surface story, but you want to get them on that other level, and this is where the gutter or the gap comes in. Let's see. The fabula in a story is the sum total of fictional events that happen in chronological order in your narrative. In other words, if the novel were taken apart and reordered chronologically, moving flashbacks to the beginning and so on, the timeline that's left, including any gaps, that's the fabula, okay? The sujet, which I don't know if I'm saying that right, is the sequence of events as presented in the text. So that's the narrative outline as opposed to the chronological outline. The mind organizes the fabula while reading. As you're reading, you organize the fabula, so the flashbacks start to fit into place and time, if it's done well. Placing events where they belong, the reader fills in any gaps with his or her imagination, finding patterns and speculating the outcome. That's what storytelling's all about, is raising questions and delaying answers. And we speculate what's going to happen next. While there's enjoyment in discovering the clues and patterns that lead to a projected ending where the reader solves the mystery, it's even more enjoyable when those projections are thwarted, especially when, upon closer examination, the clues were evident if disguised by the author. You know, you'll go back and go, wait a second, did I know that guy was in chapter two, the one who was watching them all that time? I forgot about that guy altogether, and he's the murderer. The completeness or incompleteness of the fabula is called the response gap. Our response to the gap is a conjecture and a set of expectations that are fulfilled or thwarted by the subsequent portions of the text. Thwarting the reader is usually more interesting, not only because it carries more unexpected information, but also because it can alert us to subjective reasons for our own mistakes. So if we make a mistake in what we think was going to happen, sometimes it's more about us than it was about the story. Then our own attitudes, formerly unconscious or taken for granted, become the object of our attention, and now we're looking at ourselves again. It's like looking at that face and seeing ourselves in it. We're now seeing ourselves in the text. It's the suppressed information, the gaps in the story, that make the reader work, guide the patterns, and direct the plot flow. How and what information the writer disperses to the reader is essential storytelling, and what's left out is as important as what's left in. This is from my friend Nancy Zafras, who is a novelist and a short story writer. She was a former fiction editor for the Kenyon Review. Now she's in charge of the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Her idea is, and again, this is the bimodality that I was talking about before, is that there are two stories. And to talk about how this works, she uses the image of a fish. And I'm just going to quote her because this is how she described it, and I think it works really well. This is from an email that she sent me. The way I think of it is top story and bottom story. That seems to be what helps people. Actually, I'm not going to quote her. I'm just going to tell you what I've learned about it. There's a top story, and that's what's happening in the plot. And then there's the bottom story. If you're writing in a straight line and you're writing your story from beginning to end, you're writing the top story. But in the bottom story is something else that's going on that the reader may pick up hints of, but doesn't really, it doesn't seem to be part of the plot. It's just something that's going along on the side. Here's her example. For example, a father who's the point of view character and mother attend their young son's soccer game. The father is a big sports guy, but his son never gets to play and he's upset. Okay, this is the top story, right? Okay, so maybe his son isn't good enough, but he's only 8 and whatever, or whatever, and the father has been working with him. That's the top story. As the game progresses, little hints come our way. The mother goes and talks to the coach and so on about putting the son in. There are little hints about the marriage. Then the son finally goes into the game because of the mother talking to the coach. And now the bottom story is starting to emerge, probably to the reader before it is to the father. When the ball finally comes toward the son to kick in an open field, the top story has reached its climax, right? Because we're hoping that he's going to perform well. And also, at that moment, the father can realize that his son is only in the game because of the mother and her relationship to the coach. So his marriage and his wife's infidelity has been that bottom story all along, the real story, and the reader is saying, of course, why didn't I see that? On the other hand, if you make the crumbling marriage and the wife's infidelity the top story, then the bottom or real story will have to be about something else. That's why people run into such problems when they try to tell the story they've been trying to tell for years. Once they start with that story, then the story is then about something else. People try to write about their dying mother, and the story always opens in the hospital, and they lay on the details, hoping the reader will feel the sorrow that the writer feels and feel it right away. But it's not going to happen. And so she uses prompts instead of coming up with an idea. You still have that idea in the background that that's what it's about, but instead you start with a prompt. And here's one, some prompt about wine tasting in the Loire Valley will, to their surprise, be the story about their mother's death that they've been trying to write for so long. And that's why a happy moment that ends the story, a glass of wine that they've been searching for and now how lovely it tastes, can be so sorrowful about the mother, more sorrowful than seeing the withered mother. The way this works is, to picture it, you think of a fish. And you draw a fish from left to right. This is that bottom illustration. That's the top story. And you go up to the top, and you get to the climax of that story, and then that story sinks below, while at the same time, the bottom story has been down here hiding, and it comes up, and it crosses, and that makes the tail, and that's what makes the fish swim. And it also is what makes the story swim, is that connection where that happens, they two come together. So again, it's that bimodality, it's what's underneath, what's in the gap behind the story that's telling it. And of course, the example we all know of this, and we've all read and talked about and understand, is, there's Nancy, sorry, how's that order? It's Hills Like White Elephants, where she's, the Hemingway story, where she's going to get an abortion, but it's never mentioned. We just know there's an operation going on. We don't really know. We only watch them, and it only emerges toward the end of the story what's really happening. And you as a reader go, oh, right, that's what it was. And that's sort of his iceberg metaphor as well, right, where it's more underneath. It's in the gutters, it's in the gaps, where your stories really lie. Reader response theory, and that leads us to reader response theory. Reader response theory recognizes the reader as an active agent who imparts real existence to the work and completes its meaning through interpretation. Reader response criticism argues that literature should be viewed as a performing art in which each reader creates his or her own, possibly unique, text-related performance. This is very much against what I was taught when I was back in school studying literary criticism. It was all about the author and what the author had experienced and how do we interpret, because she was abused as a child, how do we now interpret her text in the context of her own self as a writer. Instead, what this is saying, it's about the reader who is bringing to the text whatever interpretation is hers and is creating the text through that interpretation. Again, that's the gap. This is Rick Moody again on Sebald. And this is, again, the continental idea of a reader-centered text, a prose work in which the reader must take an active part. And for me, this is a way of thinking about literature that I have always found particularly thrilling. And I agree with that. After all, reading is arguably a far more creative and imaginative process than writing. When the reader creates emotion in their head, or the colors of the sky during the setting sun, or the smell of a warm summer's breeze on their face, they should reserve as much praise for themselves as they do for the writer, perhaps more. Jasper Ford, The Well of Lost Thoughts. Mind the gap. When you look at your work, look at what you're leaving out in order to give room, space, and emptiness into which your reader can project herself and become a part of your text and a part of your world that you've created, rather than just filling in all the details so that there's no room for them to move. That's what I learned from graphic novels.
Thank you.
I think we have time for questions, or which is a rarity. If you guys have ever been to one of my things, I think, wow, we even have 10 minutes at the end. If anybody wants to talk, I know some of you are real comic book lovers and may have been expecting more about comic books themselves. And you may actually know more about comics than I do and have experiences with this. Some of you are reading Watchmen. I know I had a couple conversations with people there. And you can also think about movies where, the motion picture itself is, what, 24 frames per second, and we're filling in the empty spaces in that. Television even more so, because it's just that pattern. So any questions or comments?
McLeod,
MCCLOUD.
Thank you.
An excellent example of comic fiction that I've seen is a book called Czar's Paradise. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's about the attempted Iranian revolution in 2009.
Oh, huh.
And the writer had originally drafted as a normal novel, and it's such a powerful thing that working with even editors, they figured out that it really would be better expressed through a graphic novel. And for someone who doesn't enjoy reading that, it left quite an impression.
What's the name of it again?
Zara's Paradise.
Zara's Paradise.
Z-A-H-R-A.
Next week I'm going to be teaching a novel process for writing a novel. And one of the aspects, one of the parts of that process that's really important, and you may or may not do this already yourselves. How many of you are fiction writers in here? And this also applies to nonfiction and poetry and everything. And that is dreaming the novel, dreaming the scenes, so that you're actually visualizing, not in language, but with your eyes closed, you're visualizing each scene that goes on, almost to play the movie of it in your head, without dialogue or anything, just the pictures. And from doing that, you begin to see what you don't need to say. And also you begin to sort of, the story itself will go into your unconscious so that it's part of you, and surprises will happen because we all have this bimodality going on, this undercurrent that's there for what we think is our normal life and we're normal people. We're not. And it's not normal. You're bringing all kinds of unconscious stuff into every encounter, everything you do. Just fortunately, most people can't read that, and so you're lucky you get away with it. We know you want to kill your mother. Oh, I mean your father. See? I just did it. Anything else? Yeah?
That's terrific. I just really enjoyed all the things you commented on. I just want to mention, in case others don't know about it, that I think still tonight, tomorrow night at the Bijou, they're showing Room 237, which is a documentary about people's responses to The Shining, Stephen King's The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
It's so fascinating. The creativity of response to The Shining is great, but also the way the filmmaker used Kubrick's other films to animate what could be really dry talking heads. So 8 o'clock at the Bijou, I think, still tonight, maybe tomorrow night.
Is that where he makes connections with the space program?
Yeah.
And he just got the sweater on.
really an amazing documentary. What's the name of it?
It's called, I think, Room 237.
Room 237, yeah. Which I think is the room where the twins are doing something. Yeah, in the Shining, yeah. Yeah, but, and that goes exactly to the point of allowing interpretation. I mean, we used to argue about this in English classes and lit classes, was you don't get to interpret. The author didn't mean that, and so that's not what we're going to talk about. And actually now that table has turned, and it's actually now more about the response of the reader. And so and so people are talking, you know, in other places about a book that has nothing to do with the author at all, and the author becomes an independent, or the book becomes independent of the person who created it. Usually you have to wait till you die until that happens. You can't. Kubrick's dead, right? Yeah. Anything else? No, you don't have any more questions. You can't wait to get out in the rain. All right, thank you so much.